From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. In the wake of the January 6th violent attack on the U.S. Capitol, hundreds of rioters were identified via their social media images and videos, as well as surveillance cameras. While most of us lauded the idea of justice being done in the face of creeping fascism, the fact that heavy surveillance played a serious role ought to give us pause. In a new book called We See It All, journalist John Fasman explores the disturbing extent of mass surveillance. John is the U.S. digital editor for The Economist, and the full title of his book is We See It All, Liberty and Justice in an Age of Perpetual Surveillance. Welcome to the program, John.
Thank you so much for having me.
So when we think of surveillance, we don't necessarily separate out government surveillance from corporate surveillance. And it seems by and large that most Americans are uncomfortable with the idea of government surveillance, but fairly tolerant of corporate surveillance. What sort of surveillance do you take on in your book?
Well, my book began as a series of articles I wrote for The Economist a couple of years back. And those articles looked at the way in which technology was changing policing in the criminal justice system. And I didn't really know what to expect when I started writing it. But what I found as I started reporting it was that the police have an array of technologies that have come online in the past few years that really have an unprecedented power to gather, to invisibly gather and perpetually store granular information about our lives. So the technologies that I look at are things like body-worn cameras, automatic license plate readers, predictive policing programs, risk analysis scores that can be used for bail, electronic monitoring. And then I do a couple of things at the end of the book. One is that I ask, what would it look like if you were living in a country that used all of these technologies together and the government using them had little concern for their citizens' civil liberties? So that is a perfect description of the surveillance state that China has put together. And the book is really an attempt to ask, China doesn't have any technology that we don't have now. So the book is an attempt to ask what sort of democratic practices, what sort of regulations, what sort of ways of thinking about technology as citizens do we need so that we don't become China, so that we don't build this pervasive surveillance state that once we turn it on will be very hard to turn off.
One of the issues that you take on in your book is how the Black Lives Matter protests unfolded in the wake of George Floyd's videotaped murder in Minneapolis. Of course, it was a bystander who used their cell phone, but also we saw later pieced together surveillance footage showing how that unfolded. And what that did was, of course, reveal to the public the extent of the criminality of the police. And often that is the justification for, say, things like body cameras. Well, if we want to address police brutality, let's put cameras on cops. And often we have uncovered some very serious wrongdoing from police body cameras, although, of course, they've often turned them off or thought they were turning them off. So how do you reconcile the value from being able to see it all, especially for the public, versus the fact that we are constantly being watched?
Well, I think there's a huge difference between us being watched by state-owned cameras and the power that citizens have with their own ability to put the police under surveillance, to turn the cameras back on them. The world was outraged when it saw George Floyd murdered in broad daylight in plain sight, and that came to pass because a citizen turned a camera on the police. That is one benefit of cameras in the hands of citizens, is that they can, even in situations like that where something horrific happens, they can galvanize a justified sense of moral outrage and harness that sense of outrage to press for policy changes so that something like that never happens again.
How much of this technology that police do like was actually deployed against protesters last summer? Because we know that the kinds of technology, the artificial intelligence, the facial recognition technology is often something that police have loved to use. And of course, it varies from police department to police department and city by city. But in the mass protests that took place last year, were those surveilled pretty severely?
I mean, you saw a great deal of body cam footage from those protests, right? Because police wear body cams as a standard part of the uniform now. I don't know of facial recognition being used. I would not be surprised if it was. Police use automatic license plate readers often as a matter of course. So some of these technologies may have been deployed just as a matter of course, just because police departments use them routinely. And that's one of the things that my book tries to get people to think about, is that there are these technologies that are there that are used, and they're going to be used, right? Obviously, some cities can ban them. I think San Francisco, Minneapolis, Boston, these cities have banned facial recognition, but in a lot of places they won't be banned. So what do we want if there's no political will for a ban? What sorts of regulations do we want in place so that we can take back some power over how we are surveilled?
Well, who is creating this technology? I mean, police may love to use the technology, but they're not necessarily the ones developing it. Let's talk about the tech companies that are only too happy to develop the technology and then sell it to whoever wants it. Who's developing it?
Well, there are a lot of companies that are developing them. The truth is, technology is changing the way police do their work, just the same way it's changing the way you and I do our work, right? We're sitting in front of our laptops having conversation over Zoom in a way that would have been, you know, considered odd a year ago and would have been technologically, you know, impossible 15 years ago. So there are companies that are developing this sorts of tech. I think the better question is not just who's developing it, but how is it being sold to police? So a couple of years back, I went to a conference of police chiefs from across the United States. This was in Jacksonville, Florida. And it was really vendors and high-ranking police officers talking together. You know, I don't know if any deals were done then, but often that's how deals start to happen, where you see a vendor who approach a police chief and will promise that this piece of technology is you know, it's not a silver bullet, that it'll really help reduce crime. It'll give officers an edge they didn't have before. And so what I would press people to do is that they should start showing up to city council and county council meetings so they know exactly what the police do have. How are they using it? Why are they using it? What are the penalties for misuse? How is the information stored? Just start asking questions.
How are our own smartphones turned into surveillance mechanisms? This is something that, of course, a lot of people are deeply disturbed by. Cell phone data is available. We are told it's anonymized. Newspapers use it to examine trends. For example, during the shelter at home orders last year, newspapers were able to determine how well people adhered to them or not. But what about the misuse of such data?
Well, one of the technologies that I write about in my book—I didn't mention this at the beginning, but I do write about it—is a piece of equipment called a Stingray, colloquially, and it's really an IMSI catcher, and that stands for International Mobile Subscriber Information. So every single cell phone has a unique identifying number. These IMSI catchers, which, as far as I know, because the company that makes them wouldn't talk about it, and police departments that deploy them are often under non-disclosure agreements. These are pieces of equipment about the size of a briefcase. They can fit in the trunk or the front seat of a car. And when they're turned on, they gather up information from all cell phones in a given radius, right? They essentially mimic a cell phone tower and trick a phone into connecting to it rather than the real tower. And what that does is it lets whoever is deploying one of these devices see all the non-call data from that phone. It means they can't listen into your conversations. But if you think about how you use your cell phones, you're probably not using them for actually talking most of the time, right? You're doing things like sending text messages, which the IMSI catcher can retrieve. You're browsing the web. The IMSI catcher can retrieve that. If you do happen to make a call, the catcher can determine who you called and how long you spoke for. So if you think about, and they can also obviously track your location. So if you think about in the course of a day where your phone goes and everything you do with it, if someone had all of that data, they could amass a pretty granular portrait of who you are, what you see, where you go, what you like to read, what you like to buy, what you talk about. They can know a lot about you. And I had an exec for a tech company say to me, you know, you can tell me who you are, but if you give me 15 minutes with your phone, I'm going to tell you who you really are.
So do police get to access this information? Are there police departments using the information that these Stingray technologies can scour for and gather?
There are many departments that use them. Generally, increasingly, the use requires a warrant based on probable cause. And it is used to target one specific person, but it gathers up information from anyone who happens to be in the area where that specific target of the investigation is. Now, on the one hand, you know, maybe this is no big deal because when police do a physical stakeout, they see a lot of other people in the area, right? Not just the target of their investigation. The difference is when they're on that stakeout, they can only, you know that they're not going to retain every bit of information about everyone they see. Whereas this IMSI catcher has to be, I think, deliberately, the information from that they gather, I believe, has to be deliberately gotten rid of. There's no chance that, there's a chance that it can be stored. So that's a risk that exists with tech, even when it does something that could be done manually. The risk in that storage and in that information accessibility exists in a way that it otherwise wouldn't.
Did you find in your research for your book that these technologies are deployed in a discriminatory fashion against people of color disproportionately?
Well, here's how to think about that question. Even if the technology is not deliberately deployed against people of color on purpose, you know, by the police officer using it, there's such a history of over-policing non-white communities, poor communities, communities of color, over-incarcerating people of color, that if you think of something like, think of a facial recognition database, right? I think the most benign way a police department say they use it is that they have a picture of a suspect and they want to know who that suspect is that seems to be engaged in some sort of crime. So they compare that picture to a database of mugshots, people who have already been arrested. Now, if you have a police department that has a history of over-policing, over-incarcerating non-white people, then that database that the police use is going to be disproportionately composed of non-white people. That means that a non-white suspect stands a far greater chance of being identified correctly, of being identified compared to a white suspect, right? Which seems to me a pretty gross due process violation. The other thing to bear in mind is that facial recognition often doesn't work well, especially with non-white people. It has a far greater error rate in identifying non-white subjects than it does white subjects. So the risk from facial recognition, imagine a suspect who is misidentified, you end up pulling an innocent person into a conversation, into contact with law enforcement. Those encounters often end worse for non-white people than for white people. So the problem with facial recognition is that it's dangerous when it's deployed accurately, right? It imperils our ability to be anonymous in public. It's dangerous when it is inaccurate. That's why you have a number of locations that have decided to ban it.
John, what about the older technology of surveillance, such as CCTV cameras? I mean, certainly private businesses often deploy them as security. Residential homes will install them in front of their front doors. And now we have the Amazon Rings. But what about the state deploying CCTV, cities and police departments deploying CCTV cameras just, you know, in public, in the streets?
Well, I think there are two ways to look at that, right? One of the things I saw that I found really worrying was Newark, New Jersey has a network of 126 city-owned cameras set up in locations around the city. And they have a thing called a citizens virtual patrol where you or I or anyone can access the feed from those cameras on our computer. Now, on the one hand, as the chief of Newark Police Department told me, it's just looking at a street corner. It's not doing anything you couldn't do on the street. It's not peeking into people's homes, it's not peeking into their cars, but deployed at that sort of scale, it offers a view of the city that is completely different from what you could observe as an individual person, right? And there are a few major streets that have cameras every couple of blocks. So if you wanted to, you could follow someone walking down those blocks. If there was someone who lived in sight of one of those cameras, you can see whether that person was home or not. So it's just a question of scale in that case. The other thing to think about is that even if, you know, a tiny minority of CCTV cameras are state-owned, right? Most of the ones that you see walking around are privately owned. But you increasingly have initiatives like the one that exists in Washington, D.C., for instance, where the police will pay for, I think, part, some or all, of your Ring doorbell that you install on your front door. Now, that doesn't come with an explicit agreement that you will give the police footage. But if you're an average homeowner and the police paid for this thing that you believe helps keep you safe, and then they showed up at your door and say, hey, something happened on the street, can we have access to your footage? Is the average person really gonna say no? I don't think so. So it's that sort of public-private surveillance creep that I think we need to think about, as well as just, you know, city-owned cameras.
You mentioned earlier this notion of predictive policing. What does that actually mean, and how is surveillance deployed in this sort of thing? I mean, it sounds kind of, it reminds me of George Orwell's Thought Police.
Well, it's not quite Orwellian. It is, but it is. I'll tell you exactly how it works. It's essentially an algorithm that gathers up historical crime data. What happened? What crimes were committed? Where were they committed? Under what conditions were they committed? And it uses that information to help police departments, to help police departments decide where to deploy their patrol officers. So, you know, and this is not a question of go to this neighborhood or go to that neighborhood. These predictive policing programs will break down cities into basically 500 meter square blocks and say, based on historical data, this 500 square meter block is at an increased risk of crime today. We need you to drive through there over and over again. Now, there are a number of problems with that. Number one, what kind of crimes do the algorithms use? If they use things like, you know, nuisance crimes, jaywalking, public intoxication, loitering, these aren't crimes that people call the police for, right? These are things that people get arrested for because the police are already there. So if the police are in heavier presence in poor neighborhoods, in non-white neighborhoods, than in affluent majority white neighborhoods, those areas are going to get targeted for greater police presence. And you also need to remember that historical crime data is not an objective record of all crimes committed in a city, right? It's crimes that police know about and have recorded. And so there too, even if it doesn't use nuisance crimes like loitering, you end up basically calcifying past racial biases in the name of objective data. And that's wrong. If we want to rectify the racial injustices of past police practices, we need to affirmatively stop them. These predictive policing programs, unless police departments make a real effort to think seriously about the crimes that they're trained on, to think seriously about how to weigh the information they're given, these programs really risk calcifying these biases in the name of objectivity.
Let's talk about ankle monitors. This is this idea of letting people who might otherwise be incarcerated to be free, quote unquote, but wear an ankle monitor is seen as a positive reform of our system of mass incarceration. But why is it really insidious surveillance?
Well, I think the first thing to do is to acknowledge that, yes, if you're arrested, being out with an ankle monitor is better than jail. But we also have to acknowledge what an incredibly low bar better than jail is.
Right.
The risk with ankle monitors, there are a few. Number one is that it risks widening the net, right? You can imagine a judge who is weighing whether to give bail or not give bail, you know, say just wear an ankle monitor and we will put you under surveillance that way. Another risk is that they often malfunction, right? So I talked to someone who had an ankle monitor for several months, but the ankle monitor would get so hot that it scarred up his leg where he wore it, even his clothes. I talked to someone else who, you know, there's a battery that you're supposed to be able to charge twice a day, but in fact, the battery malfunctioned and it would go off when she was on her way to a job interview. And she ran the risk of being remanded, being sent back to jail because she couldn't get home in time. So there are those sorts of risks. We need to think about how we deploy them. You know, are they working? Often jurisdictions will make people who are arrested pay for their own ankle monitors. So a woman I spoke to in Indianapolis, she had to pay $50 a day. And as she put it, you know, just because you tell me I have to pay $50, that doesn't mean I have $50. And if you can't pay, you end up going back to jail, you end up remanded, and you end up footing the cost of your own surveillance.
What about the way in which the government actually partners up with private companies? And we talked a little bit about this already, but, you know, we have some very big companies today gathering data on Americans. This is that idea of corporate surveillance. Every like that we click on Facebook, that's all data that these companies gather in the interest of marketing to us. But potentially this data is also available to share with government actors or authorities that ask for it. Is that happening?
I would not be surprised if that is happening. The fact that I can't tell you, you know, means that we have to do some investigation into how this data is used. That's why, you know, I say this is not, what I've written is not an anti-police book. It's a pro-citizenship, pro-democracy book. This is our data that's being gathered up, and we should have a say over how it's used and how it's stored. The idea that there is, that, you know, once this data is out there, that it's just free to anyone, we should rightfully object to that. You know, we should object to the fact that you know, police departments will often pool facial recognition databases. So I think there's a study that came out, at Georgetown University study that came out a few years back, that said that one in every two Americans had their face in a police accessible, an FBI accessible database. Well, that's not because half of us have been arrested. That's because we have driver's licenses, we have passport photos, and depending on what state and county we're in, those photos could be accessible to police officers from a range of agencies from all over the country. So we really should take a say. We really should, you know, make sure our voice is heard in figuring out where that data is stored, who gets access to it, and what are the penalties for accessing it improperly.
Is a big part of the problem the fact that the technology is racing forward faster than government regulation to rein it in? You know, we also, for example, you write about drones, and this was an issue that a lot of people are uncomfortable with, the idea of an unmanned vehicle flying up in the sky with a camera attached to its bottom, being able to see, you know, what you might be doing in your own backyard. You know, we don't really know if our government, which of course these days it's hard to get any sort of serious legislation passed, has really caught on to the fact, or caught up to the fact, that these technologies are there, potentially violating existing laws and certainly not being regulated with new laws.
Yeah, I think that's a problem. You know, technology is, tech development is quick, right? Move fast and break things. That's a dictum. And democracy is slow and can be ponderous. And so you'll often have situations where the policy and the jurisprudence just hasn't caught up to the technology. The fact is, a lot of our Fourth Amendment jurisprudence was written for an era in which our information that we wanted to keep private could be locked in a secure physical cabinet instead of on our phones, you know, in property of a company that is perhaps domiciled in another country. So the jurisprudence hasn't caught up. It's begun to. I mean, there's some encouraging decisions. I'm thinking of decisions like, you know, Carpenter, that says you need a warrant to search someone's phone. But it hasn't caught up. That's going to be the project of courts over the next, you know, decade or two, is thinking about what should Fourth Amendment protections against illegal searches and seizures, what should those look like in an age in which so much of our information is stored in non-tangible ways, non-physical ways?
And then finally, you mentioned China at the beginning of our conversation. Yes, China's surveillance state gets a tremendous amount of attention from US-based news media that don't necessarily put the same or apply the same standards to our surveillance state. So how do you compare the invasiveness of China's surveillance state to the US's?
Technologically, there's nothing that China is doing that we could not do if we wanted to. And that's why the question I asked at the beginning of this broadcast, the question really guided my thinking on this book, was asked to me in conversation by a brilliant law professor at Berkeley named Catherine Crump. And she said, you know, what democratic practices do we need to not become China? And the reason that question is so smart is that it makes clear that we're not talking about a technology problem here. We are talking about a democracy problem. And if we're talking about a democracy problem, then we can also start talking about a democracy solution. We still have open meetings laws. City council meetings are accessible to us. County council meetings are accessible to us. We have a First Amendment right to petition the government for a redress of grievances. So if we want to not become China, the solution isn't in thinking about what sorts of technologies, you know, the solution is not to think about it in terms of technology. It's to think about it in terms of democracy, in terms of regulation, in terms of doing what governments do for practices everywhere else. I mean, just set reasonable standards and set penalties for people who violate them.
Well, John, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Much more to discuss, but certainly our audience can pick up a copy of your book to explore it in its entirety. Good luck to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
My guest has been John Fassman. He is the U.S. digital editor of The Economist, and we've been discussing his new book, We See It All, Liberty and Justice in an Age of Perpetual Surveillance. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.